Laws are great. Laws tell you what life was like in the past. If you ever had a time machine and you ever wondered, what would it be like to travel back and actually live in such and such time? I say, study the laws of the period. And why? Well, because in the history of the human race, no one has ever woken up one morning and gone, do you know what? At some point in the future, someone may do that thing, and that thing would be bad, so let's make up a law to stop that thing from ever happening. No. Throughout mankind's history, what has happened is someone has done that thing, usually several times, and eventually people go, oh, for God's sake, we need to ban that thing. And they make up laws, which is basically a community's way of going, see that crap you're doing right there? Stop it. You're not allowed to do it anymore. And because you've done it so often, we're now making elaborate rules to stop anybody else from doing it. As such, my pet theory is that when you look at the laws of a place, you get an insight as to what it was actually like living at the time. And with that in mind, welcome to London in the year 1274. King Edward I has just taken the throne. A rich Welsh wine merchant is mayor of the city. He'd been set up by rich oligarchs after they destroyed the regime of his popular predecessor. And above all, it's a time of change after the long miasma of the reign of Henry III. But what was it like to live there in London in this year and the years around it? What were the rules and regulations, and by extension, the issues that so plagued life in London during this era? Well, let's find out. Hi, my name is Saul, and I'm the writer and narrator of The Story of London, a podcast that tries to tell the entire history of London as a single narrative tale. And after many recent episodes relentlessly trying to keep track of a lot of twists and turns in the city's politics, it's time, I feel, to slow down for an episode and just, I don't know, look around. See just how different, or just how similar, the residents of London were back then compared to the residents of London today. Welcome, then, to chapter 102 of The Story of London, The Nimbys of the 13th Century. So let's start with just an explanation for anybody who's not from Britain and has never heard the phrase before. And I'm aware I do have many foreign listeners, and thank you for listening. Hope you're enjoying it. A NIMBY, N-I-M-B-Y, is an acronym, and it basically stands for Not In My Backyard. And it refers to a class of persons on whose principal motivation is for something to not happen near where they live. So, for example, we all understand the importance of waste disposal, and everyone knows that waste incinerators need to be built to dispose of waste. But at a base level, a NIMBY is somebody who would seriously object to having an incinerator built anywhere near them. There is more to it than that. It's not always just objecting to something as objectionable as a waste incinerator. It could be objecting to people painting their doors green. But it is a sentiment that is universal, and I contend timeless, especially in London. People would see things happening in the streets around their homes and go, stop that, I don't want to see that near my home. And they would complain. And the complaints would go to the people in charge of the city, and they would eventually sigh and turn it into a rule. I'm going to start with a single regulation that for me sums up the NIMBY attitude best, I feel. It's a regulation in London, written about this time, that simply says, quote, no barbers shall be so bold or so daring as to put blood in their windows openly or in view of folks, but let them have it carried privily unto the Thames, under pain of paying 2 shillings unto the use of the sheriffs, unquote. Now, this particular regulation is especially grim, and let me explain why it's grim. Medical services around this stage of human history were rather primitive. Now, I know, there's lots of people in the 21st century who believe our ancient ancestors were highly intelligent medical practitioners who had great wisdom, which modern pharmaceutical companies seek to hide from us. But honestly, no. Most of the historical beliefs about medicine were, really stupid. Take, for example, bloodletting. That is a belief that if you were sick with, say, cancer, the cure would be to slice open an artery and then you bleed out as much bad blood as possible, which ties into the idea of humours within the human body, a theory that thankfully nobody subscribes to anymore. Now, bleeding out as much blood as you can is not a cure. In fact, it's the opposite of a cure. And it's very easy for us to look at this and go, people in the past were idiots. But in truth, given there are actually people today who believe in such things, it's easier for us to say that they weren't idiots. They were just ignorant of how bodies actually worked. And they sought simple solutions to complex problems. Solutions that made them feel emotionally better, like they were doing something. I mean, for all our disdain of bloodletting, we have to accept that partaking in it probably allowed one or two experience a placebo effect, at best. Maybe. At worst, several people died from the amount of blood they lost. But what makes that particular law I mentioned really interesting is that the barbers, and it was barbers who practiced bloodletting, mainly because they had access to razors, well, they seem to have been advertising how good they were at bloodletting by displaying large quantities of blood in their windows or on display for all to see. Oh, look, Miss Miggins was in yesterday with a limp, so I cut open her leg and look how much bad humoured vitae extracted from her. That's quality work, that is. Now, the blood could well be human blood. It could also be animal blood, and they did bleed animals. But whatever the case, folks objected to barbers having blood in their windows. I mean, after all, blood has a very noticeable smell, congealed blood also, and it looks, well, there's a window over there and it's got a bucket full of blood in it. So the regulation went out. Stop doing that. Dump that crap discreetly in the river. And if you won't, the sheriffs will dump the blood in the river and will charge you 2 shillings for the expense. See? Not in my backyard. A NIMBY sentiment, there in the 13th century. Speaking of rivers, the Thames wasn't the only river in London. Right now, the Fleet and the Walbrook were heavily used, and there's an interesting regulation that says, quote, "The watercourse of Walbrook and the highway of His Lordship the King shall be kept clear, so that no dung or other filth be thrown therein, to the disturbance or annoyance of folks," unquote. Now, people may remember from previous episodes I went on about how important the Walbrook was. It was, well, it was what divided the city between the East End and the West End. It was a source of water, and it's also where, according to that rule, people were dumping human shit into it, and also onto the streets nearby. Again, since most regulations are written after the fact, and we also know from the many references we have about whenever anybody important turned up to London, they ordered everybody to clean the crap of the streets. Here we see people being given strict rules that certain places were meant to be kept cleaner than others, the Walbrook being one of them. But it wasn't exclusively a place where they needed everything to be kept cleaner or less crowded than other places. I mean, the regulations from London at this time clearly state that, quote, "All the lanes leading to the Thames from the King's Highways, from Castle Baynard unto the Tower of London, shall be kept clear, that so persons on horseback may, without hindrance, ride and go unto the Thames. And if it be not so, the sheriffs shall cause the same to be done at the cost of those who have caused the impediment, and nevertheless, that those who impede be heavily amerced," unquote. For those who haven't picked up on it, immersed is an old phrase meaning fined. So, here's a rule saying, along with the River Walbrook, all the streets around the River Thames had to be kept clear so that people could go to and from the ships, I suppose, but also because, first impressions count, and if the streets are covered in crap, But it's more than just crap here. They are talking about the streets being blocked up. people dumping stuff in or near the river, and that crucial series of roads needed to be kept clear. These are arguably some of the busiest parts of London. But sometimes these blockages weren't caused by bad hygiene or even laziness. They were caused by paperwork. The bylaws from London from this time state, quote, "Whereas merchants have been oftentimes molested by the bailiffs of the city, sometimes for 8 days and more, so that they could not offload and harbour their goods and merchandise which they brought by water, or place the sum in safety, the king doth will and command that from henceforth no one shall be molested in such manner that he cannot freely at his arrival unload his goods in due and ordinary places," unquote. This speed up of the process of offloading goods was coupled with other ordinances about clearing the streets and removing things that would block traffic going through London. And what kind of things? Well, you see it in one of the ordinances where they complain about all the things that, well, made travelling the streets of London so difficult. Quote, "Keeping clean the lanes without accumulation of dung and filth, and free from annoyance by chips and stones, penthouses, gutters, jetties of houses, stands for carts shod with iron for use of the city, corn porters, carts with wood for sale," unquote. Now, some of those things need explaining. The obvious ones are obvious, you know. Making sure the streets aren't filled with dung and filth is, well, you know, that's the toilet problem. But it notes how it mentions penthouses and jetties of houses. There were no bans on building on top of your house or building out of your house, and that could obstruct the roads. And it's also worth noting that people were just selling stuff, corn porters and carts with wood for sale right in the middle of the city, and they wanted to ban this. And as such, they wanted to regulate and stop this, to allow traffic move, but also to, well, improve the smell. And it's probably because of the smell that other regulations stand out and other offenders become clear. Like when the bylaws of London clearly say that, quote, "No sellers of fish shall throw their water into the king's highways or into the lanes, but shall cause the same carried unto the Thames," unquote. Now that's obviously because if anybody's been around the selling of fresh fish, and you store them in ice or you store them in water, that water stinks, and if you throw it onto the ground, the stink isn't going to go anywhere. The regulations of London also covered mercantile behaviour. And we have strict rules governing regrators. What is a regrator, I hear you ask? Well, that is someone who buys and sells a commodity for profit. Now, as far as we can tell, what was going on is that a rich person, or simply someone just temporarily flushed with cash, could arguably wake up one morning, make their way to the markets of London, and there they could decide to buy up, all the fresh fish that happened to be on sale that day. And they could go around offering more money to buy up every single piece of fish in London before 9 a.m. and then be the only person selling fish for the rest of the day at an inflated price and therefore make a clear profit. Now that sounds like a blatant scam, but it clearly happened. And we know it happened because one of the bylaws of London specifically said that, quote, "No regrator of corn, of fish, or of poultry shall buy provisions for resale before the hour of prime rung at St. Paul's, or before the men of the land and of the city shall have bought their provisions, under pain of losing the article bought," unquote. So here we see a really good insight to what was going on in London and how the city operated. The regulation says that you could not buy stuff for resale before the hour of prime is rung over at St. Paul's. Now, prime is traditionally rung around about 6 a.m, give or take. So the rule says that the regrators can't buy stuff before 6, which was clearly said because obviously certain raw materials, corn, fish and poultry, were clearly for sale before 6, which tells us that people were waking early in London. They also then add the caveat that the ban was in effect, yes, till prime, but until folks had bought their provisions, which possibly extended it after 6 to maybe 7 or 8 or maybe even 9 at the latest. In other words, London isn't banning folks doing this. They aren't banning people buying up everything to sell at an inflated price. What they did was regulate it, so it had to wait to allow anyone who had their act together to get their food. And then after that, if the slow coaches can't get their act together before 9, they have to pay over the odds. Which is a really interesting way to how the markets were operating at the time. And speaking of trade regulations, as you can see, London was fairly heavily regulated. And across the river, Southwark was fairly heavily regulated. But there were very few trade regulations on what you could sell on London Bridge, which is why probably people started to sell things on London Bridge, and why, rather than come up with all new regulations, London simply said, quote, that no market shall be held upon London Bridge, but only elsewhere in the city where they are established, unquote. But the regulations and the rules of London didn't just empower merchants. They empowered the normal residents. Like an heavily armed home owners association, London added provisions and they regulated how people should build their homes. But we'll never know the exact population of the city at this date, and there are some vast guesses as to how many were around exactly. It is fair to assume that as a ballpark figure, that around about 1201 there was about 30,000 souls in London, and by 1301 population was around 80,000, with the possibility there could be even more. The bottom line was London was growing and London was expanding. And as such, you start seeing that having so many people rammed in next to each other behind the walls of the city of London made it very crowded. And because it was very crowded, people started, well, running into each other. And as such, you suddenly start seeing rules and regulations people had to obey. So, you know that image we have of ye traditional medieval house where the floors above overhang the ground floor? Well, there were strict rules on them which said, quote, that the penthouses and jetties of houses shall be so high that folks on horseback may ride beneath them, and that they shall be of a height of 9 feet at the very least, and that all others shall be forthwith rearranged within 40 days, under a penalty of 40 shillings unto the use of the sheriffs, unquote. I love this because it clearly shows, right, we're saying now all houses, you've got to have a 9-foot clearance on all new builds, and all old builds have just over a month to get their act together, or we're charging them 40 shilling. Like a good HMA, they wanted to regulate what would happen when people set up their own wee stall or shop outside their homes. They didn't want them to disturb their neighbours too much. Quote, and that no stall shall project from the house beyond the width of 2.5 feet, and the same shall be movable and flexible for the convenience of the neighbours, unquote. And, you know, that sounds like standard good neighbourly behaviour. If you're going to start selling stuff from outside your house, don't jut too far into the street and be prepared to move stuff if we need it. But these rules were caused because people were not being good neighbours and they were blocking streets off. As you can imagine, with regulations like this, it's fair to assume neighbours complained about their neighbours. People argued when somebody's house impeded upon their home. These rows dragged on and ended up with rules that sound like they could only be written after dozens of these rows had erupted on the crowded streets. Let me give you a good example. Look at the rules concerning gutters. Quote, although a person may have been in possession for a long time, the water that drops from his house, it not having a wall of stone, falling upon the vacant land of his neighbour, still, such neighbour may build upon said land whenever he shall please, and may remove the eaves of the said house, unquote. So, let's get that right there. Had you, say, a nice 3-storey house in London, and you've got a gutter on the roof of that house, and the rain would fall from to the roof and then into the gutter and then trickle off onto a patch of land next to your house, and you've had that system in place for the last 10 years or so, you're lovely. But if your neighbour, who happens to own that empty land, decides they want to build something on it, he has the right to mess with your gutters in order to facilitate it, in order to stop water falling on his land. Of course, This leads to complications, and the rules on gutters then go on to say, quote, and in such case, the person building must carry off the water that falls from the said house without detriment to his neighbour. The same is to be done also as to rain gutters that discharge themselves upon vacant ground, unquote. So yes, he can mess with your gutter and you can't stop him, but he can't block off your gutter. He has to make sure that whatever he builds will tie into your existing guttering system. Think we're done? Not even close. Quote, and if a person's rain gutter shall discharge itself into the gutter of his neighbour, or shall run through the middle of his tenement, such neighbour may not stop up such gutter, and even if he shall pull down that house and shall think proper to build it anew, he shall still be bound to receive upon his own land the water falling from such gutter, and carry off the same as before he used to do, unquote. You get the impression that these regulations were written by someone, some clerk in the guild hall, sighing to himself and looking up at a bunch of people all arguing and complaining and going, oh God, they're complaining about the gutters again. But you also get the impression that folks cared about such things. Not much different than people today, really. People cared about their homes, and while building planning regulations were very lackadaisical compared to today's standards, we just need to remember that all we're seeing today is take these rules and add, you know, 600 years of extra arguments on top of them. But we also see some very sensible building regulations, such as, quote, no chimney be henceforth made except of stone, tile or plaster, and not of timber under pain of being pulled down, unquote. And given how often London's burned down, not having wooden chimneys is a very good idea. Speaking of which, fire was a worry. I mean, as we've covered, the city has burnt down several times in the past. And we do see the beginning of fire regulations. Primitive ones, but they were there. Such as the one that said people, quote, who dwell in great houses within the ward have a ladder or two ready and prepared to secure their neighbour in case of misadventure shall happen by fire, unquote. Or the other rule that said, quote, that all persons who occupy such houses have in summertime, and especially between the Feast of Pentecost and the Feast of St. Bartholomew, before their doors a barrel full of water for quenching such fire, unquote. You also see other regulations that were clearly born from a city where most of the buildings are made of wood and it can and will burn down if we're not careful. So you have the rule that says, quote, no person throw straw, dust, dung, sawdust, or other refuge into the streets or lanes, but cause the same to be taken by the rakers and others to places ordained for receiving such dirt, under penalty of 2 shillings, unquote. And yes, there were street cleaners at the time, the rakers. And in fact, the ordinance say, quote, that they shall have rakers sufficient for the cleansing the wards of diverse refuge, and order the constables to help them to collect their salary from the folks of the ward, unquote. So yeah, there were street cleaners, professional ones, rakers, and they were paid for by the locals. The impression you have is that life in London was crowded and fractious, and the rules show the causes of many arguments. My personal favourite being the simple stipulation that says, quote, that no person rear swine, oxen or cows within their houses, and the pain of forfeiture therefore unto the chamber, unquote. I mean, imagine that complaint. Councillors, my neighbour has an oxen in his house, like an actual oxen in his house. Sometimes the city ordinances reflect widespread social fears, such as the one that said, quote, no leper shall be going about in the city or shall make any sojourn into the city by night or by day under pain of imprisonment. But such persons shall have a common attorney for themselves to go each Sunday unto the parish churches to collect alms for their substance, unquote. So here is a rule that deals with the genuine fear of lepers. And it meant that they were forbidden to enter London at any time and had to remain around lazar houses like St. Giles and the Fields But each Sunday, they could send someone to turn up and collect food for them to survive. They may have been shunned, but nobody wanted to leave them to die. Other complaints that led to banning behaviours, however, are much funnier, and I especially adore the rule that said, quote, "No person shall keep a school for fencing or for buckler play within the city under pain of imprisonment," unquote. Yep, fencing schools where people were to learn how to sword fight, totally banned. Possibly so as not to encourage trouble, also possibly because they were noisy and accidents could happen. But I just like this rule as it allows me to say with a straight face that 13th century London banned martial arts dojos. There were other types of rules that are variations of this. See, London didn't like certain behaviours. One of which was, well, doing virtually anything at night. Nighttime for London was problematic. I mean, we just witnessed over several chapters events in London taking place after dinner or at night. What kind of events? Well, just to remind you, groups of armed citizens battling each other on the streets. We've got mobs claiming to be from the authorities, turning up, smashing their way into homes and stealing anything not nailed down. We have other groups skulking the streets and opening lanes blocked by private landlords and more. The impression we have is that London was very menacing in the evening. And thus from this, you start seeing rules and regulations governing evening behaviour in London. And the most obvious one being, quote, "It is also forbidden that any person shall be so daring as to be found going or wandering about the streets of the city after curfew rung at St. Martin's Le Grand or St. Lawrence," unquote. So yeah, they tried to impose a curfew. It didn't always work, or they didn't always impose it strongly. So then they had a proviso, which was that the people who were forbidden to go around were forbidden to go around, quote, "with sword or buckler, or with other arm for doing mischief, whereof evil suspicion may arrive, or in any other manner, unless it be some great lord or other substantial person of good reputation, or a person of their household, from whom shall have a warrant, and who is going from one to another with a light to guide them," unquote. These are strict rules. No one's allowed to travel the streets of London armed with sword or knife, unless it is an earl of somewhere, some of the earl's men, and even the earl's men need warrants to carry their weapons. And that rule goes on to say that, quote, "If anyone shall be found going about, contrary to the form aforesaid, if he have no occasion to come so late into the city, he shall be taken by the keepers of the peace and put into the Tun, which for such misdoers is assigned, and on the morrow he shall be arrested and brought before the mayor of the city and the aldermen, and according as to they shall find such a persons have offended and are therefore accustomed, they shall be punished," unquote. The reference to the Tun here is a reference to the Tun prison, which was to be built around about 1283. And that was a prison located on Cornhill and was apparently, it looked from the outside like a barrel or a tun of wine, hence its name. And it was built specifically to deal with night walkers, which was the term for anyone arrested during evening hours for whatever reason. They were to be escorted to the Tun, locked up and dealt with in the morning. But I'll talk more about the Tun and why it was built in 1283 in a bit. Mentioning these rules about night behaviour is just a way of displaying how London was coming to terms with the idea that people didn't just walk the streets from A to B back in the 13th century. There were rules at the time which clearly showed that there existed a nighttime economy. And then as now, the nighttime economy of London caused the authorities problems which caused them to write laws to try and deal with it. And what kind of laws? Well, consider this one. Quote, "Whereas such persons going about by night do commonly have their resort and hold their common meetings in taverns more than elsewhere, and do there seek shelter and lie in wait and watch their time to do ill, it is forbidden that any person shall have a tavern for wine or for ale open after the hour of curfew aforesaid, and they shall keep the taverns closed after such hour. Unquote. Well, there you go. No late night or even early night bars are allowed. All the taverns had to close at curfew. But it does appear that people had bypassed this regulation and found a little loophole that nobody thought of, which is why the bylaw then goes on to say, quote, nor shall any person therein sleeping or sitting up, nor shall anyone receive persons into his house from out of the common tavern by day or by night, except those for whom he shall be willing to be answerable unto the peace of the king, unquote. In other words, this added caveat suggests that when the ban of taverns opening at night was put into place, these taverns simply kept their doors open. They just didn't sell any booze. I mean, those were the rules. You can imagine a publican at this time looking all innocent and saying with a straight face, yeah, I know I let in those four lads, lords, but I didn't sell them any alcohol. They just came in for a chat. Maybe sleep here tonight. No law against that, is there? And there wasn't, until finally they did make a law against it. And it's also clear that this wasn't a small problem, based on the punishment the laws dictated. Quote, and if it shall be found that any taverner does otherwise, he shall be put on his surety, the first time by the hanap of the tavern, or by some other good pledge therein found, and he shall be immersed in the sum of 40 pence. If a second time it shall be found that he is offended, he shall be immersed in the sum of 0.5 mark, and the third time in 10 shillings. The fourth time he shall pay the penalty double, that is to say 20 shillings. And the fifth time he shall forswear such trade in the city forever. Unquote. Yep, 5 strikes, you're out. But multiple offences of this type do seem to have been the norm. And the laws go on to say, quote, if any taverner shall receive any bad character, knowing that he has been a transgressor, he shall have the imprisonment that is provided for all receivers of felons. He shall have the imprisonment that is provided for all receivers of felons, unquote. Which is clearly a rule saying, stop giving shelter to wanted men on the run. But this raises an interesting situation, I think. Banning the sale of alcohol after dark, indeed banning people going to taverns after dark, or even wandering the streets, is basically introducing a prohibition on behaviour. And as we know from history, prohibition never works. It cannot actually work. Prohibition just drives a type of activity underground, and it turns the people who did it into criminals, which means that they now have a sudden affinity to other criminals. Meaning that, as we've seen in the modern age, once you introduce prohibition, you create criminal fraternities. And that's what seems to be happening here. Taverns are giving shelter to men wanted for other crimes. And indeed, this was such an issue that the bylaws of London go on to clarify, quote, that every alderman in his ward mote shall diligently inquire as to misdoers resorting to and staying in his ward, and if any such person shall be found by presentment and indictment of the good folks of the ward, they shall be forthwith bodily attached, and that by the aldermen, if the sheriffs and the bailiffs are not present, but if they are present, they shall do the same by command of the said aldermen. And such persons shall be brought before the mayor and aldermen and shall be interrogated as to that for which they were indicted, unquote. So yeah, people on the run from elsewhere would come to London and lose themselves in the busy streets and find places to hang out. The nighttime economy of the city in the 13th century saw illegality and criminality seemingly meshing together. And certainly, running a tavern starts being seen as an unsavoury thing. Consider the bylaw that states, quote, it is forbidden that the mayor, sheriffs, aldermen, or their clerks, sergeants, or beadles shall from henceforth brew themselves or by others for sale, or shall keep oven or wine tavern, or shall trade in any other thing to which a low estimate is attached, unquote. So, yeah, here is a clear instruction that civic leaders should not engage in that sort of thing. But the motivations may not just be snobbery here. It could also be out of fear that if any of the officials engage in such a trade, they could slip into that world of illegality and criminality, of shelter for criminals and of dark deeds. And I cannot stress to you how big the fears of London's authorities had been to this umbral world of crime and illegality. We can see that from the sheer number of rules written about the nighttime world. And we can see genuine fears about London's nightlife going all the way back to 1192, when the French writer Richard of Devizes described London as being filled with, quote, actors, jesters, smooth-skinned lads, moors, flatterers, pretty boys, effeminates, pederasts, singing and dancing girls, quacks, belly dancers, sorceresses, extortioners, night walkers, magicians, mimes, beggars, buffoons, unquote. But one has to wonder, was this being driven by a rampant crime rate going on at night? Or was it the fear that simply drove it? Fear and scandal. And we have to mention scandal, because nighttime is when forbidden things happen. And of course, that led to the rule that simply says, quote, that no courtesan or common brothel keeper shall be residing within the walls of the city under pain of imprisonment, unquote. Now, just to go into context before we start talking about the sex industry in London, what must be understood is that during the reign of Edward I, concerns about ongoing issues with night crime and prostitution grew nationally. The building of the Tun Prison in 1285 was actually the result of King Edward passing an entire series of laws intended to deal with growing issues of nighttime criminality across the whole of England. And London was acutely aware of the reality of such things. And it's best summed up in this section to do with governing who should be in whose houses. Quote, whereas thieves and other persons of light and bad repute are often, and more commonly, received and harboured in the houses of women of evil life within the city than elsewhere, through whom evil deeds and murders by reason of such harbouring do often happen, and great evils and scandals to the people of the city, unquote. And there it is. The nature of crime itself. Crime begats crime. Criminality begats criminality. Where there is prostitution, there will be theft. Where there is theft, there will be assault. Where there is assault, there will be murder. And this is why the city actively sought out such places, with instructions being given, quote, let the warden cause search to be made throughout the city in the best manner that he shall see fit. Where such women are received, and who they are, and then, when they shall be found, let their limits be assigned to them, and let no such person from henceforth wear miniver or sendal on her dress or on her hood, and if any shall do so, let her lose the miniver and the sendal. And as such miniver and sendal, let the same be forfeited unto the sergeant who shall have found such a woman and have taken her in such guise, unquote. So it starts with giving instructions to people to go out and find where the prostitutes are living. But it gets really interesting here, because here are rules dictating fashion. The miniver is a name given to a type of fur collar on robes, or the fur lining of a hood. These days you only see minivers in the robes of aristocratic types. And the sendal is a name given to expensive silk garments, the old French word for fine linen being sendal. Here the rules clearly state that any such woman being found wearing these clothes should be forbidden from wearing such fine clothing in the future, which is suggesting that some women were wearing them. Now, it is about this time that usually when we talk about medieval standards towards sex, that we also talk about the double standards applied to the sex trade in patriarchal societies. You know, how it's always women who get punished but never the men. Now, whereas that's true, this wasn't entirely the case back in the reign of Edward I. Now, don't get me wrong, the sex workers in London are voiceless and lost to us, sure, but the puritanical misogynistic streak of, look, these shameful, lustful women we expect to see in historical records, while there, There also does seem to be a willingness to engage the men who exploit women in this trade. The regulations clearly state that in the first place, quote, that if any man shall be found to be a common whoremonger or bawd, and shall of the same be attained, first let all his head and beard be shaved, except for a fringe on his head, 2 inches in breadth, unquote. This is where I find 13th century legal remedies to be fascinating, because dictating how criminals looked, so as to make them recognisable to all, does seem to have been a clear weapon of choice. Here we see bawds or pimps were given 4 silly haircuts, so everybody could know their sin. But this degree of public shaming carried on, because after that was done, the instructions were, quote, let him be taken unto the pillory with minstrels, and sat thereon for a certain time at the discretion of the mayor and alderman, unquote. Notice the mention of minstrels. It's not enough to be taken to the stocks on West Cheap, today Cheapside, for public display. You had to be led there, in procession, with musicians singing aloud who you were and what you just did for all to hear. Let your crime be known for all to witness, you and your stupid new haircut. Public shaming is everything. And if this, by the way, was not enough incentive for you to stop, quote, and if he shall be a second time attained, therefore, let him have the same punishment. And besides this, let him have 10 days imprisonment without ransom. And a third time, let him have the same imprisonment in the same manner, and afterwards let him be taken to one of the city gates. And there let him forswear the city forever, unquote. Interestingly enough, the rules for women who were running brothels were roughly the same, but it did say, quote, if any woman shall be found to be a common receiver of courtesans or bawd, and of the same shall be attained, first let her be openly brought with minstrels from prison unto the thew, and sat therefore for a certain time, and then let her hair be cut around her head. And then if she shall be a second time attained, therefore, let her have the same punishment in the same manner, and then besides this, let her have 10 days imprisonment, and the third day, let her have the same punishment in the same manner, then let her be taken to one of the gates of said city, and let her therefore swear the city forever, unquote. So yeah, it's basically the same punishment, but with differing haircuts. Still, it's always good to know. If you do intend to travel back to the 13th century, oh female time travellers, don't go back with a short bob haircut. Everybody's going to think you run a brothel. But these were the punishments on the bawds, the pimps. What about the sex workers themselves? Well, in 13th century London, they did face copious punishments. Quote, if any woman shall be found to be a common courtesan, and of the same shall be attained, let her be taken from the prison unto Aldgate, with a hood of ray and a white wand in her hand, unquote. And here she would wear a striped hood of some kind, and had to carry a white wand. Quote, and from thence, with minstrels, unto the thew, unquote. So again, minstrels singing her crimes and causing her shames with their new stripy hoods and the big white wand. And according to the regulations, female sex workers convicted of their crimes were taken to a place called the Thew, which is located in today's unfortunately named New Cock Lane over in West Smithfield. And after being taken to the Thew, quote, and there let the cause be proclaimed, and from thence, through Cheap and Newgate to Cox Lane, there to take up her abode, unquote. So here we see the route of shame laid out for these women to be processed along, to be sung about, to be made to wear uniform and seen by all. This punishment happened for the first time she was caught, and the second, and on the third time, quote, let her have the same punishment, and let her hair be cut round her head while upon the thew, unquote. So after the public stocks for prostitutes on the third offence, their hair-cutting ritual seems to be done in public, followed by the stipulation once again they're kicked out of the city. The residents of London clearly did not approve of publicly being caught and named doing certain things. Not in our backyard. And remember, when it comes to sexual morality, sometimes going after sex workers wasn't enough. I mean, what if people were having affairs? Oh, London had laws on that kind of thing also. Quote, if any person shall be impeached of adultery, and therefore lawfully attained, let him be taken unto Newgate, and from thence, with minstrels, through Cheap to the Tun on Cornhill, there to remain at the will of the mayor and alderman, unquote. Again, rituals of public humiliation and the use of the morality prison, the Tun. And these punishments were not just being done on people guilty of straightforward adultery. The rules go on to say, quote, if any adulteress shall be found with a priest or with a married man, let them both be taken unto the compter of one of the sheriffs or unto Newgate, and from thence to the Guildhall before the mayor and aldermen, and there arraigned, unquote. And after being brought to these city authorities simply for, you know, having an affair, and if they're found guilty, quote, there let the said adulterer and adulteress be shaved like an appealer, and from thence with minstrels let them be brought through Cheap unto the same Tun, there to remain at the will of the mayor and the alderman, unquote. Head shaving, songs proclaiming their sins. Justice was a colourful thing in London, filled with cruel mirth and happy songs, with mockery and public shame. I could go on. No, really, I really could go on with a whole host of other rules and regulations. The Liber Albus, the great white book of London, is filled with hundreds of pages and pages of the medieval laws of the city from this period and onwards. And in between the moralistic, judgmental attitudes, what becomes clear is a sense of a crowded, salacious, sexy, smelly city, endlessly moving and heaving with life. It is a city filled to the brim with life and passion, where all the grand narratives about politics and mayors and kings and nobles, this was nothing compared to the drama of London streets. It was a complicated place, as complicated as anything we see today. And why? Because it was filled by people. And that's the true lesson of the NIMBYs of the 13th century. A city is not its laws. The city is not its regulations. It's not its street plans, and it's not its grand buildings. It's not its politics, and it's not its lords and ladies. A city is the people, the residents, their passions, their lives. And this entire episode, from all its length, is but a minuscule taste of how incredibly complicated and diverse London was back then. And how then as now, if you just scratch below the surface, you would find the everyday drama of everyday people caring about everyday things. And you'd never get bored. And I'm going to leave it there. Now, I'll just let you know, I'm going to return many times to the street lives of London and to its crimes and to its scandals, the practicalities of life. Heck, I'm planning a couple of episodes just on what it was like being a child and growing up in London, but that's all to come. But for now, I'll end it there. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this little excursion away where we just had a look at just some of the rules of London at the time. And I'll return next week for another chapter in the story of London.